Some of the modern renderings of the text really capture the sentiment of a passage, and I particularly like what Eugene Peterson had. I don't recommend modern versions as your primary study guide, or your primary text, but as a study aid, I find them to be helpful. And we talked about the first part of this chapter last week, but I think, again, the way he has rendered it really helps us to appreciate Paul's irony. Will you put up with a little foolish aside from me, please, just for a moment? I can just feel the irony dripping from the corners of the apostle's mouth here. And it gets even thicker before we get down to the end of the paragraph. And the reason he makes this appeal to them is that he says, the thing that has me so upset is that I care so much about you, and this is the passion of God burning inside of me. And I promised your hand in marriage to Christ, presented you as a pure virgin, as a pure virgin to her husband. And now I am afraid. Let's get back over here. Let me do it this way. I think it'll work better. And now I'm afraid that exactly as the snake or Satan seduced Eve with his smooth patter, you are being lured away from the simple purity of your love for Christ. They had set themselves up to be vulnerable to the approach of these false teachers. And one of the things that we find out later on in this chapter is that they were enamored with their skilled speech. Slick talkers have been around for a long time. And they usually have a ready ear, a ready following. And that's the way I picture these false teachers in Corinth, is that they were slick-talking dudes. And it's tragic what had happened. But when we consider the comparison here, and that is that Satan approached Eve with a slick line, and she just took the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. And he says that's exactly the problem that we're dealing with here. And the end result of it is that your minds would be corrupted. And then in verse 3, that as the serpent beguiled, deceived Eve. Now, just think about this for a moment. She undoubtedly had no problem understanding that that God had said, don't eat of the fruit of that tree that stands in the middle of the garden. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. That's not anything that's obscure or, mystical. And so Satan comes along and says, you can eat it. So, how, why couldn't she see that? What is it that resulted here in this deception or beguilement that is, again, something we need to be tuned into, because Satan operates the same way today. So if we can understand how he worked in her case. I'm sorry? You will not surely die. Mm-hmm. So, the word here means trickery or craftiness, and so, one of the tricks that Satan has up his sleeve is he just tweaks the scriptures a little bit. Just twist them a little. And the end result, he says here, is that you will be corrupted or defiled. The word means to ruin or to destroy. Now, we're not talking about just, you know, a weird thought. You know, so, well, you know, everybody has, you know, strange ideas, and, you know, you got your idea and I've got my idea and that sort of. No, he's talking about the total destruction of the mind in terms of its purity. And that's a danger that we all need to be on our toes and on guard against. Curtis.
You know, something that's always bothered me. I know the serpent, why did he talk to him and got him to do that? But why did Adam do it? He certainly knew better.
He sure did. He stood right there and let it happen. The reason he did it, that as best I can determine, is he was a wimp. Well, I think that's clearly implied from the statement that Paul makes about it in his letter to Timothy. He said, the woman was beguiled and hath fallen into transgression, but Adam was not beguiled. That's 1 Timothy 2:14. So he knew what he was doing. And he did it anyway. And that's because he was a wimp. He would not stand up to error. And really, that's what has been happening ever since, is that people who refuse to stand up to error, or stand up to a lie, they, you know, give in to it. Now, I don't know all of the reasons why he gave in to it, but he did. He just yielded to it. Jim?
Didn't he also promise her something else, too, that she would become as God?
Uh-huh.
So that was something she desired.
Right.
And so he promised her it would happen because he knew she wanted that.
And it looked good to eat. Right.
And so I think the correlation is with the soft-speaking false teachers are teaching them something they want, in a sense.
They
want
to hear.
They want to hear. And so they're willing to follow it, even though in a sensible notion they would know that it's wrong. And also, don't you suppose these people were taught to speak by the Greeks in their schools, possibly? And these soft-fucking, self-promoting kind of thought?
I think that's implied later on in Paul's dramatic irony, yeah.
I think it's people are lured away because it's easy. You know, you got to Saturday night service to the police services on Sunday morning, or, you know, you can, you know, have your service at the beach. I don't know. There's so many things that...
Entertainment,
exactly.
Well, you know, what Paul says in 2 Timothy 4 about the future certainly applies to the past, too, again, because Satan hadn't changed his tactics when he said the time will come when they will not endure the sound doctrine, but having itching ears will heed to themselves teachers after their own lust, will turn away their ears from the truth and turn aside to fables. So that's nothing new. Been going on ever since people have been listening to Satan. Yeah, Paul?
We can use an example of last week, the week before, by putting a little arsenic in. You know, that's all Satan did, is put a little bit in there.
Yeah, just a little lot. And the purity that is toward Christ. So, how much impurity does it take to pollute a pure whatever? You know these clean rooms? Whenever you used to go down to the Cape and put together the shuttle and the satellite and all that kind of stuff, were they worried about dirt and like one little speck?
Yep.
I mean, it's in the purging of the air, the whole nine yards. I mean, it doesn't take but just one little speck to make something that's pure impure, does it, Jim?
There was a time when, you know, churches were autonomous, the somewhere back in our history, there became a sponsoring group that decided who would preach for what congregation was sent to them. What was that called? You don't know what I'm speaking of?
Well, I don't know which one. Which?
And the church divided over that.
Well, are you talking about like Herald of Truth?
Disciples of Christ.
Well, that too, yeah. I mean, you can go all the way back to...
Okay, and then when that happened, then everything else snowballed into other things, like instrumental music and a myriad of things. So when the church split again over sponsoring this Indian organization in 1956, so my father, though there's a point to this, my father went with the more liberal group when all of the churches between here and Venice divided. But then there was probably 20 of them for him to choose from. When they divided over that, he found a group that had what he thought was proper elders. But it didn't take 5 years before he could not find one group of Christians that had legitimate elders. And the point is, once you break away from the truth in one subject, then nothing sticks anymore.
That's a valid truth. Yeah. You know,
that made him quit. He became discouraged.
I know we have to use language accommodatively, but the fact remains is that there's no such thing as the Lord's church splitting. Because there's not a Lord's church in the sense of a, you know, physical body here with some sort of a hierarchy. You know, we're all autonomous. But you're right, there was a division and there was a lot of turmoil and it was called a church split. And I guess accommodatively I can go along with that. But technically...
Stand for something,
yeah. And so, this is a major concern for Paul, this digression, because he said it destroys the mind and the purity, their spiritual purity, which is toward Christ. And the way it's happening, he says, if he that cometh preacheth to another Jesus. So that's one thing that was being preached. And now, we're not told what that is. And it's kind of like Jim just said, you know, when you go astray in one point, it can be a bazillion other things. And just like, you know, it can be, you know, it could be the virgin birth. It could be the resurrection, which we know is a problem. It could be his deity and on and on and on and on and on. Yo, we're not told. But whatever it is, it's certainly not the Christ that Paul preached. Which, you know, reminds us of Galatians 1. You know, I marvel that you're so quickly removing yourselves from the gospel that I preached unto you to another gospel, which is not another gospel, Paul said. And anybody that comes preaching that, let him be anathema. Well, same thing here. A different Jesus, whom we did not preach. Or if you receive a different spirit, I appreciate the fact that in the, at least American standard, they didn't capitalize it or try to imply that that is the Holy Spirit, because I don't think it is. We're not told, but I think he's talking about the attitude of, and because this has been consistent in his argument throughout the book, and that is the attitude of Christ. You know, Paul said that the way he operated was on the basis of emulating Christ and his attitude back a couple of chapters ago. Well, their attitude is the attitude of Satan. And and he's going to call them that down about verse 13 following. And so if these people are embracing these teachers and their teaching, they're embracing the attitude of Satan, the spirit of Satan. Brother Curry, in his commentary, has a couple of pages on this, because the commentators are all over the map on it. But as he points out in the context here, it's consistent with what Paul's been talking about to view it as their bad attitude. And if you have a bad attitude, that is toward Christ, toward His gospel, toward the toward Paul, then that's not good. Okay? And which you did not receive, or a different gospel, which you did not accept. If they had accepted the gospel Paul preached, remember 1 Corinthians 15? They believed it, they obeyed it, and they were standing in it. 1 Corinthians 15, two or three verses there. But now, here these guys come along, and they've got a different twist. I don't know what this different gospel is. You know, it's probably the Judaizing teacher influence, and it doesn't really matter, like Jim said a moment ago. It doesn't really matter what it is. If it's a digression, it's wrong. It's corrupting. It's destroying. And they're buying into it. And that's nearly 2,000 years ago. And people are still buying into a different gospel, a different Christ, a different spirit. And there are as many differences as there are denominations, probably times 10, because within each denomination you probably got, you know, a multiplicity of differences there. So who knows? But the difference, if it differs from the gospel, if it differs from the Word of God, then it's Satan's gospel, plain and simple. Now, people take offense at that. They say, oh, that's hard. Well, that's what Paul calls it here in just a minute. What you said a moment ago about your dad just getting so discouraged he gave up. And we know that's not the thing to do. So what must we do? I mean, if all these problems, all these, you know, differences, all this stuff that's flying around, what in the world can we do about that? And to keep from getting disheartened, discouraged, and giving up, we just keep on keeping on, right? That's right. That's what Satan wants us to do. He wants us to give up. He wants us to say, nobody can agree. It's all just a sham religion, and people are just following their own ideas and thoughts. Well, mine's just as good as anybody else, and away they go. Just remember who the enemy is and how he operates. You know, Paul said earlier on in this letter, we're not ignorant of his methods, and we know how he operates, and let's get ready for it. And just when it comes along, just recognize it for what it is. And remember, we're not fighting against our peers. We're fighting against Satan when we're fighting error. It's not a... And that's hard to remember. It really is. Whenever, especially if somebody's attacking you like they were attacking Paul, it's hard to keep in mind that really the enemy is not the person that's attacking you. The enemy is Satan. And if we can keep it in that perspective, it makes it a whole lot less emotional, I guess. Right.
Because we get caught up in all of the here and now and what's in front of us, we forget who God is.
Mm-hmm.
And we try responding, it's
tough. Yeah, in whose army we're in.
Right.
The Lord's army. Right. It's not Ken's army, or it's not the Huntington Beach Army. It's the Lord's army.
And I guess you have to realize that it's your attitude that counts and your fight to get there, right? So even if you're in a church, the only one that you can find to attend and do that battle, you could be the one soul that's doing what's right with God, where others aren't within that same congregation.
Well, that's a theoretical possibility. Then you have to examine your own conscience as to how much error you can embrace in terms of your presence or your fellowship. I've heard it said, because I wasn't around, so I wasn't there, but you know, Paul can probably testify to this, maybe some others. Whenever the issues started cropping up in the 50s, that some of the fellows that knew the truth and decided, you know, and knew what the truth was, yet they stayed with the digressives. And some, I've been told this, and some said, well, we're going to stay here and we're going to get them straightened out. And as far as I know, I don't know of any case where that worked. Bob Bolton told me, and Bob, the one that baptized me, he's gone now, but Bob said that Tom Warren taught him the truth on the issues whenever he was in Fort Worth. That Tom knew what the truth was, and that, and I guess Foy Wallace did too. Now, Foy took kind of a hands-off, again, I'm just reading history and listening to what I've heard, but he never really tried to defend it. He just took off on another tack and spent most of his energy, I guess, fighting premillennialism, and he just kind of observed the Passover on the issues. Is that?
Yeah, that pretty much. He back in the 40s, in the Clayton world, you could read their stuff, and I know there was no doubt where they stood on things. And then after the break, well, then Clayton, you still read Clayton stuff, it was still there. But Foy, in his writings, was pretty much there, but you started seeing it change. So.
Mm.
And then he just, like I say, he just took a different tack. He worked strictly on premillennialism and the merger. And those were the two things that he dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
But he would go, and he would, whether it was the one or the other, he would go to whichever one wanted to come through. And John, all he was doing at that time was holding meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But he just showed from one place to the other. But he wouldn't touch them.
Yeah.
Now, I've never heard him touch them.
In his writings, I've read what he wrote, and I can say, especially in the 40s, boy, I mean, right down the line, just, you know, solid as a rock of Gibraltar in what he was writing, which is kind of reminiscent of what Paul is charged with, you know. Oh, boy, whenever he writes, he's right down the line, but then whenever he shows up, he doesn't say anything. Is the charge that was made against Paul. You know, his letters are weighty, but his words are weak, they said. I don't know what Brother Wallace's motives were, but I know of another fellow that was preaching where my wife worshiped, and of course my father-in-law was a deacon and then later on an elder, but there's a good deal, I think, of evidence that some of those fellows went where the majority of the money was. They were looking at their paychecks and looking at their salaries, and a lot of fellows that were standing for the truth were losing all their support. They were the preacher, and they were in the minority, and they got booted out the door and on the street and had no support. And back then, too, it was meager at best. And so it's entirely possible some of those fellows decided that, hey, if I'm going to put clothes on my back and, you know, feed my family, I better line up with the folks that got have the money. And apparently some of them did that.
It's hard to say why someone does.
No, unless they tell you.
But I know some men that during that period of time, they left, they got money, but they were not popular prior to that, and a lot of the digressive congregations were the congregations that were popular. Just leave it there. That was.
Yeah.
Now, whether that was the reason that went there, well,
no, we don't know. You know, they and the Lord are the only ones to know, for sure.
But the thing
sure leads to an invitation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when we give up, they will be frustrated.
You know, meetings were being canceled right and left, and a lot of fellows sort of depended on their meetings. They fed off their meetings both physically and probably some of them were, you know, they got a charge out of that. You know, they were very highly sought after meeting preachers, and if they were going to lose that, they didn't want to give it up. Which, you know, we're not, this wasn't the subject of our text, but this, I think this is good for us to review this, because again, when talking about the way Satan operates, he is going to use every trick in the book, and whether it's an appeal to a man's pride or his pocketbook or his prejudice, you know, maybe all of his buddies are over here, you know, and he doesn't want to, you know, segregate himself from his buddies. Again, there's just so many different techniques and tactics that Satan has, and he's going to pull out all stops. Hmm. Are you talking about the fellow in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fox?
Very good. But I know a number of men like that, and some of them will just, if you ask them about the children, they'll take the line against it. 100%. But when it comes into the congregation, the sponsoring congregation, they can't see it anymore.
You know, I don't remember, I know some of you have heard this, but just before my mother-in-law came out in a Bible class on Sunday morning, 2 weeks before she came out, they got off on this. She worships at a congregation that is of the institutional persuasion because she can't get anywhere else. Kind of what Jensen was talking about a while ago.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, she's not physically able to get anywhere else. We'd like to figure out some way to change that. And maybe, Lord willing, we can do that someday so that we can have her with us where, you know, she can be again with, because it really is a concern to her. But anyway, the discussion as she relates it in the class went that one of the fellows that was there used to be a preacher, and he went through that period in the 50s. And he said, oh, those Annies, they were just a bunch of greedy money mongers. They wanted the money for themselves. Well, that's not that is a prejudicial statement, and it's a technique of Satan, that is to vilify the adversary because they couldn't attack their teaching, so they attacked their motives and their person. And so, you know, to her credit, she called him and the elders up afterwards, and she said, that is not true. You know, what he said, and of course, then they started backpedaling. And then she went home with a bunch of material that I gave her to give to them that is really good. Bill Hall preaches a series of sermons on this, and he does it in a very kind, loving, straightforward way. And so she's going to give it to him, and then she's going to invite for me to go down there and talk to him. But I'm not going to hold my breath. But anyway, what my point is, they didn't try to argue from the scripture. That was not their tactic. They just took an emotional hot button and took off with that. And unless somebody was there that really knew what went on and what the arguments were. Now, yeah, granted, there were a lot of things that went on during that period of time that were bad. You know, they were very ungodly, so behavior on both sides. But that's the way, again, if Satan can push somebody's hot button and he can get people, you know, all in a dither like that, well, he's just happy as a clam.
You know, I remember that a lot of people, if they even hinted like they were going to speak out against their own the truth, back then they were able to add, it didn't make you know what they said, anything else, they were happy because they were against their own truth. Hmm. That's what really brought it all to the head, was their own truth itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was such a big push on back in that area. I don't know about out here, because I went out here, I know back then. There was a big push on to get support for the Herald of Truth. Well, they could go worldwide with the gospel.
Right.
The leadership, the elders, the time.
Right.
Well, if someone's in the voting, how can they oversee the work of the church here?
Yep.
Why, you let the banana.
Yeah, you're against evangelism.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we're all for it in this.
And that's what caused, that's where the problems came.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of name calling.
Yeah. So, we are not ignorant of the way Satan operates. And, you know, in a sense, that's exactly what Paul's detractors were doing. They were name calling. They were calling him names. Labeling him because they certainly couldn't attack his doctrine, so they're going to have to attack his character. Now, oh, I just figured out one thing over here, it looks better. I really like verse 5, the way Peterson rendered it. Because, you know, the American Standard, I reckon that I'm not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles. But if you put up with these big shot apostles, and as Curry points out, this is one of the most biting statements of sarcasm in all of Paul's writings, where he speaks of these guys as chief apostles. Because that's what they had elevated themselves to, is this level of, boy, we are the big shot, hot shot, you know, 24-karat gold-plated apostles. So Paul says, if you put up with these big shot apostles, why can't you put up with little old me? I love it. I'm as good as they are. Well, little old me, of course, is what they were trying to make him out to be. That's the way they characterized him. He's a nobody. He's just a blowhard. It's true that I don't have their voice, haven't mastered that smooth eloquence that impresses you so much. Their smooth and fair speech. But when I do open my mouth, I at least know what I'm talking about. And when I read Brother Curry's literal rendering of the text from the Greek, that's basically it. I mean, Peterson had just about literalized the Greek text here. And we haven't kept anything back. We let you in on everything. No hidden agenda, no ulterior motives, no, you know, sneaking around, all of the shenanigans that these guys were pulling. Paul said, in effect, we're up front, we're playing, we're just out there for everybody to see. You know, what you see is what you get. And so, again, the way he manipulates them, and I say that in a positive sense, is that they were putting up with these guys. They were, you know. And Paul says, okay, if you're going to put up with those guys, then why don't you listen to me? For just a little while. Yes. These that are claiming to be. The ones that he names later on as being on Satan's team, the false apostles. Yeah. No, he's not. And some commentators think he's talking about Peter. And the context is clear. He's talking about these yahoos that are the false apostles, the deceitful workers, the ones that are fashioning themselves into apostles of Christ. Verse 13. Because these are the ones that these Corinthians are listening to, that Paul says, are preaching a different Jesus, a different gospel, and engendering a different attitude in people.
But was in Jesus' actual prison, which is our department to be an apostle? Well, I guess it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Paul's not through being grammatically ironic. I wonder, did I make a bad mistake in proclaiming God's message to you without asking for something in return, serving you free of charge so that you wouldn't be inconvenienced by me? Now, here is sort of a paradox. First of all, you know, Paul had talked about the fact that he didn't want to be accused of being a mercenary, so he didn't take support from them. Now, since he didn't take any support from them, what they're saying is, well, if he was anybody, he'd be taking money from you. So obviously what he's saying is not worth anything because he doesn't think it's worth anything, and he's not charging you or taking wages from you. So, you know, you can't win. If you take money, you're a mercenary. If you don't take any money, then what you say is worthless. Because everybody knows that if you have something really important to say, then you're going to take money for it. So Paul, well, I guess I blew it when I didn't take your money and just served you for free. Oh, you know, they got to be squirming by now, you would think, wouldn't you? It turns out that the other churches paid my way. I took wages from them so that you could have a free ride. You know, one of the clear teachings of the Bible is Old and New Testament. Is that whoever labors in the Lord's vineyard is worthy of wages. You know, both the old, you know, the Paul quotes from the Old Testament back in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 on this. You know, don't muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. It is our God-given responsibility to support the preachers of the gospel. And we should rejoice in that. And I really appreciate the support that I get. I'm not saying this because I'm not happy with what support I've gotten. You've been very kind to me and are very kind to me. But some people begrudge that. And it's really, as Paul talks about his fellowship with the churches in Macedonia, it's a partnership that we should rejoice in, that we are privileged to be able to have a part in or a joint participation in this matter of spreading the gospel. And we are. That is one of our unique areas of partnership. And by the same token, something else that, and this goes back to what Jensen was talking about a moment ago, and this is something that that I've always had deep conviction about and also I'm sensitive to, and that is, I want to make sure that the fellows that I'm in partnership with are preaching the truth. And we had to make that decision here a few years ago, you know. And I cannot conscientiously be in partners with somebody I know that's going to be teaching somebody something that's going to cause, if they believe and follow that teaching, it's going to cause them to lose their soul. And this indifferent attitude that a lot of people have towards those that teach a different doctrine on marriage and divorce. Well, you know, that, you know, just as long as they're, you know, just as long as I have an opportunity to teach the truth on it, then they can teach what they'll teach, and I'll teach what I'll teach, and we'll let people make up their mind. I'm sorry, I cannot do that. Because when you support somebody monetarily and, you know, any other way, give them the hand of fellowship, whatever, you are supporting what they're teaching. You're a partner in it, really. The Greek word that's translated fellowship literally means partnership, koinonia. You are a partner with them. Now, do we want to be partners with false teachers? I don't, and I know you don't either. So that means we've got to make sure the best we can. Now, I know we can't, you know, we can't go out there and listen to everything that somebody's saying and make sure he never slips up, but we can do due diligence to find out and stay tuned in to what's happening. And eventually, if there's some digression and you're vigilant, you'll find it out. You know, somebody will hear, something will turn up. And it's really sometimes almost providential the way it happens. I'll tell you, when I was preaching at Fairview, I had something to say in a lesson on Sunday morning about marriage and divorce and remarriage, and this lady who was a visitor came up to me, and she said, I disagree with what you said. And she told me what her position was, and so we continued to talk. And this was back before Homer Haley had written his book, and his position had been widely publicized. And what was usually said about Brother Haley was, well, he holds that position privately, but he doesn't teach it. But here's the rest of the story. That lady kept talking. I asked her where she was from, and she was from Arizona. And then pretty soon, I said, well, what is the most compelling argument that you can make for that position? She said, well, you know, I was talking to Brother Haley about this, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, she got it all from Brother Haley. You know, she didn't get it out of the Bible. She got it from what Brother Haley said about it. And so, I don't buy that if you hold it privately, because if you talk to one single solitary person, that's not private anymore. And if you talk to one single person and cause them to lose their soul, that's serious. It's not a personal thing against the individual. And I have a greatest amount of respect and admiration for Brother Haley's teaching, especially the work that he did on the prophets and all. But I'm sorry. What he taught, if people followed it and they practiced it and they were in that position, they're out of God's favor. You know, plain and simple. I could not be in fellowship or partnership with him. I could not support. I could not have either in regular support or a gospel meeting. I mean, that's support. You know, you invite a fellow in for a gospel meeting, and we have it around here, and there's a lot of people that say, doesn't matter, because they're not going to teach it. Well, they won't teach it while they're here, and so what they do when they get back to Timbuktu, that's, different matter. It is not. I'm sorry. Paul?
Yes, sir. One other thing I wanted to talk about, we had a responsibility to support. But just we had a responsibility. He's not hired by the congregation.
Yeah.
He's supported by the congregation to preach the gospel, to teach the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. He's not hired to do the visitation. He's not hired to go to the hospital. If he does those things, then why is he not hired to be a teacher? So if they do those things, it's because of the love of Christ, not because they're hired to do it.
Yeah.
That's something that many people forget.
Yeah, and when we're, and again, I really appreciate the attitude of the men and most of the members here too, because that is not, I have not detected that here at all. Which is rare. I'll tell you, it's rare. Well, you know what? We didn't get very far down the road, but I think it was a productive discussion. Brother Cantrell is going to pick up where I left off next week, and he asked me if I was going to get through with 2 Corinthians before my vacation, and obviously the answer is no.